Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'd like to welcome you tonight to the MSU Libraries and to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. This is the last event for this semester of the Writers Series, but we already have a lineup set up for next winter, so please keep an eye out for that, and I hope to see you back in the wintertime on Friday evenings here in the library. Tonight's guest is Mark Sheehan. Mark Sheehan was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1954. He holds degrees in English from Western Michigan University, Central Michigan University, and the University of Michigan. His poems, fictions, and essays have appeared in such journals as Appalachian Quarterly, Atlanta Review, Kansas Quarterly, Louisville Review, Michigan Quarterly, and many others. He is the recipient of grants from the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowments for the Arts. His poems have recently been anthologized in New Poems from the Third Coast, published by Wayne State University Press, and his essay, A Different Kind of Priest, appeared in Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan, published by Michigan State University Press. He is associate editor and book review editor of Fourth Genre, Explorations in Nonfiction, a journal also published by the MSU Press. His book of poems, Greatest Hits, was published by New Issues Poetry Press in 1998, and there are copies of it up here that are available for sale after the reading. He currently lives and writes in Grand Haven, Michigan. Please join me in welcoming Mark Sheehan.
Good evening. Thanks for pulling yourselves away from the all-election news channels to come out for a poetry reading. I'd like to thank Peter Berg and the MSU Library for inviting me and for putting together their various reading series here. I'm going to read a few poems this evening from my book entitled Greatest Hits, although I'm primarily going to read some newer poems that I'm working on putting together a second manuscript of poems. I'm going to read for 35, 40 minutes. I'll be happy to answer some questions after that, or I'll hang around afterwards to speak more informally if you want to. Also, I hope everybody can hear me okay. Okay, and if you want me to repeat a word in a poem you don't understand, or a line, or an entire poem, or if you have any questions along the way, please feel free to raise your hand and I'll do my best to repeat or answer. I'd like to start off with a poem. Several of the poems I'm going to read this evening have some kind of connection to Lansing or the East Lansing area where I've lived for many years. The first poem that I want to read has only a sort of tangential relationship. I helped a friend move from East Lansing to Portland, Oregon, and really got a chance to see the country driving a 27-foot U-Haul trailer. When we were going through Ogallala, Nebraska, we went over this bridge, and there was a sign that said, to watch for wind on the bridge. And it struck me just immediately. It's like, can you physically see the wind in Nebraska? And I actually began writing the poem almost immediately, since it wasn't my shift to drive. I think the only thing else you need to know in this poem is Vincent is, of course, Vincent van Gogh. Driving through Nebraska. Outside Ogallala, there's a rise with a sign warning you to watch for wind on the bridge, as if you were Vincent, who saw it in huge blue swirls curling around the stars above Arles. Except that here, the sky seems too small to cover the miles and miles of Nebraska, flat as the earth before Copernicus. Or maybe Nebraskans can see angels. Maybe the gazers into crystal balls all call Omaha their home. These are the kinds of thoughts that haunt you when you stop the truck to piss and consider how full of Nebraska Nebraska is, how there are people who live without regret, even in Nebraska. They say, I just can't see being blue, and that's just water under the bridge. To think on these things helps to bring the soul into a state of grace and the body with another hour's drive to Wyoming. A couple of years ago, I had the fortune to spend a couple of weeks in Ireland and stayed in a small cottage in County Clare, a cottage owned by Tom Lynch. Does anybody know Tom Lynch's writing? He's the undertaker of Milford, Michigan, and is a terrific poet and essayist. This was a cottage he inherited from his, I believe it was his great aunt. One of the things that Tom, since a lot of his writer friends stay there, one of the things that Tom asks his visitors there to do is to, if they do any writing during the time they're at the cottage, is to write it in this blank book that he has there, which is great fun if you're a visitor to flip through and read the other things that people have written. So this is my, this was my contribution to it. Actually, this was another poem that I wrote. I often agonize over poems, but this is a poem I actually wrote very quickly, almost completely as is, while I was still in Ireland. This is entitled "The Ontology of Mourning in Mauveen County, Clare." I was damn proud of myself to get to use the word ontology somewhere. "The Ontology of Mourning in Mauveen County, Clare." The crow has opinions about things and is not afraid to proclaim them. So does the little black and white songbird whose name I'd know if only I were more awake. Unseen, the ocean's blue voice is muffled by a mile of fields green between stone fences. The sound of it rises and falls and seems urgent and almost intelligible as voices overheard behind closed doors. Or maybe it's talking plainly in Gaelic. The truth is that I really can't say just what the waves are saying, or what the nameless black and white songbird sings from the top of the peat shed's peaked gray roof, or what the crow crows about with such certainty all morning. One more poem about Ireland. It was really quite remarkable that the poem mentions Gaelic in rural County Clare. It's still very common to be able to go into a pub or a store and hear people speaking in Gaelic, which is a beautifully melodious language. Although, even when people are speaking English, it's very difficult. We had a couple of friends and I went into a pub in Carrigaholt and drinking a pint of Guinness with one of the locals, and this guy was telling this, I'm sure it was a wonderful story having something to do with Ireland and Al Capone, and we kept nodding our heads and understanding about every 10th word. One of the most remarkable things I saw while I was there is in the Irish countryside, there's little shrines, little religious shrines all over the place. The most amazing one I saw was right near the coast, and it was this whitewashed structure, a little bit larger than a phone booth. And inside it, it had images of the Virgin in it, and there was a little pool, this tiny little pool of not very clean water in the bottom of it, and a little jar for offerings. And it was in the middle of this circle of raised earth that was covered with grass. And it really looked very pre-Christian. I mentioned that story because I mentioned the word druidic in it, and it really made me think more of the Druids than of Christ, this little shrine. Maybe the one other thing to know about this poem is that in Ireland, it's a cultural thing we found out when you go into a pub, not that we went into pubs much in Ireland, that when you go, one of the real common drinks to have is you can order a whiskey and lemonade, and what they will bring you is a glass of neat whiskey, and the bartender will set this bottle of sweet red soda pop in front of you, and then you can mix them in whatever ratio you want to. So after a while, we got the hang of going into bars and ordering whiskey and lemonade and feeling like we were kind of belonging there. And the poem has all that in it, and also is some kind of meditation on myself being Irish. My ancestors apparently emigrated like many others did during the famine of the 1840s, and going back and sort of having a connection and sort of not. It's entitled "Genealogy." On the cliffs outside of Kilkee, County Clare, little rivulets falling to the sea are lifted by the wind and driven inland, back over the narrow road running between private fields and a strip of common land. Sometimes a grazing cow wanders too close and falls 100 meters down to the beach. Sometimes sunshines builds rainbows all along the coast road. Any woman who you meet might have a cow skull in her bathtub in secret places to hunt for crystals. And if the pub owner owns that grassy field, a primitive druidic shrine to Virgin Mary is built on, who else would you think collects the coins from the offering jar? Better to get some Guinness in return. Better to find your own stones. Better yet, whiskey on the side, mixed with red lemonade for sweetness and to pretend that you belong. One more new poem before I read a poem or two from the collection, and I'll switch back and forth between some newer poems and poems from the collection. I'm currently living in Grand Haven, and has anyone been to Grand Haven and seen the musical fountain? Well, this is for you, because I do too. I live very close to the waterfront, and for those of you who haven't had this unique cultural experience, the musical fountain is this thing that every night about dusk, these great sprays of water lit by colored lights suddenly go up to the tune to the strains of Das Sprach Zarathustra. And the colored lights goes up, and there's this disembodied narration that goes on, and it's really quite, it's something you got to do once, and once you've done it once, you never need to do it again. And so I get to hear this every evening. And from my bedroom, I can kind of see just the tips of the water jets while this is all going on. For those of you who read Elizabeth Bishop, there's, I think, something of Elizabeth Bishop's poems that creep into this. And maybe the only other thing to know is that Balanchine is, of course, the famous choreographer. The musical fountain. Each night during tourist season, it starts up just after dark, at the base of the sand dune they use to set off fireworks on the 4th of July. One night it's show tunes, the next R&B, classical or pop, homogenized to a safe, if loud, goo of Muzak. Across the harbor, the great sprays of water lit up by colored floodlights dance a computerized set of moves. They look like spray from the hoses of firemen rehearsing a rescue choreographed by Balanchine. From my study window, I can see just the pinnacle of each jet when the music is at forte. If they were gas jets, I would be seeing just that burning tip where the gas has gone from music to sunlight. When the wind blows off land out toward the lake, I might not hear it at all. I might be half asleep before I remember just what left a hole of silence in the evening. This year, I'm staying on past Labor Day. Who wouldn't want to be from a place where the fountain spouts hymns on Sunday evenings? Tonight, how great thou art, wet flames dancing in the rain, punctuated by thunder. I like both the lightning out over the lake and the fountain's tacky majesty. They seem like competing theologies, grace that you're given and grace you have to earn. From here, both seem equally within reach. So I watch the storm even after the fountain winds down and set the alarm for work. One of the sub-themes, I guess, of putting the poems together was thinking about, again, those various kinds of journeys. And another sort of cultural moment in the United States, and this is where I start making my my poetic connections to the University of Michigan. My mother was a graduate of MSU when it was still Michigan Agricultural College. In 1933, the Ball Canning Company, because she had won some kind of contest, hired her to go to the 1933 Chicago World's Fair in Chicago and to be an employee at their booth at the exhibition. The theme of the 1933 Chicago World's Fair was a century of progress. And maybe the only other thing you might need to know about the poem which I think is fairly self-explanatory, is one of the great attractions was a woman named Sally Rand, who was sort of the original exotic dancer who did this dance with a couple of ostrich feather fans. And for everything else, she got most of the attention on the 1933 World's Fair. This poem is really creatively entitled, The 1933 Chicago World's Fair. The 200-foot-tall Haviland Motor Oil Company thermometer read 83 degrees, incongruous to that century of progress where even the smooth Art Deco buildings were built for speed. The Ball Canning Company employed my mother to man their booth showing various pears and relishes preserved in cool blue jars. Center stage was Sally Rand, the woman who stole the show, her nom de plume taken from an atlas of road maps, who danced to Clair de Lune employing only two cleverly used ostrich feather fans. In that ephemeral Byzantium, the Hall of Science unveiled its glittering predictions. The avenue of flags snapped in the wind, and the transparent man, his organs viewable as last summer's fruit, raised his veined face and arms as if employing the anxiously awaited future to arrive. Going back and forth a little bit, a newer poem. My brother, going the next generation, I never went to MSU, so I broke the chain here. My older brother went to MSU and had the misfortune to leave the university and his student deferment behind. But that's another story and another poem. My older sister, I grew up in a small town outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and was part of that generation, I think, that was moving between being rural and being urban. I always lived in the country, but in the moment of my family's history when I was growing up, my father gave up any pretense of being a farmer and became a factory worker in Grand Rapids. The one kind of memory I have that a photograph I looked at brought back was my older sister was in 4-H, and as part of a 4-H project, she raised a horse that became part of family legend by becoming wild soon after she gave up on the 4-H. So this poem is based on this photograph of myself and my father. Blue ribbon. Head, heart, hands, and health are the 4-H's. This snapshot's a part of my sister's project, a gelding that's her whim, in which in 6 years will be wildly unrideable, God knows. Though now he's so docile that my father drops the halter to have both hands ready to pluck me, his sunburned peck of pink fruit from this long-legged, muscle-shivered cradle. I hold on to the leather horn as though I'm ready to break this wild bronc, this life. The horse holds its breath, a trick for keeping the saddle from being cinched good and tight. Its curried tail flares softly in the wind. The barn doors are opened to chaff-flecked light. A rope to hang a worn tractor tire swing comes down plumb from a blue cloudless sky. From heaven, the parish priest believes. I think I will hold on for as long as I can. That poem is several others where I for those who might be interested in such things, I tend to write a lot of poems in a sort of loose blank verse. One of the reasons for that is I have not been an academic for a number of years and have worked a 9-to-5 job, and there's something kind of time-saving in having a form that you're going to sit down and work in, and you know that the poem's going to fall into when you get there. This is a poem that is the only rhymed poem that I will attempt this evening. The last place I lived before leaving the Grand Rapids area was a rental property out on Peacock Road, just past the what's the nursery out there? And it was a place where people had, you know, it's a your basic rental property. People had left a bunch of things in the basement. There were a number of interesting things that people had left on the perimeter of the lawn, including a 1940s vintage vacuum cleaner. So I sort of did my best to make it home. And having been a renter most of my life, started thinking about that and thinking about my place in this moment. And my history seemed to be more about a part of the place than the place a part of me. So this is from my former place out on Peacock Road. Rental history. Who planted the Japanese ornamental? Who the blue spruce, lilacs, the two unpruned ragged apple trees? Some faded plastic markers proclaim eggplant and tomato. What tenant years ago left behind this garden whose perennials now are goldenrod, thistle, and burdock? Stacked behind unfastened locks are empty mason jars. The yard's mostly weeds. Apples ripen into pears. Moldy beneath basement stairs are catalogs of seeds. One more new poem, then I'm going to move back and read a couple of poems, two or three poems from the book, and end with a new poem or two. A few years ago, I was attending an outdoor concert on the campus here at Michigan State, and was seated near the area that they had set up for people with disabilities. And once the music started, someone got up and began signing for the band. And it was really remarkable thinking about music being translated into sign and having people there watching the music being translated into these signs being carved into the air. And they happened to be playing blues on top of it, so that the poem that eventually came out of that experience is entitled Signing the Blues. Right in front of the outdoor stage are the differently abled, who used to be the lame, the deaf, the crippled, and the blind. They have canes, crutches, and motorized wheelchairs. At the eastern edge of the field, a full moon is asking for forgiveness or attention. A young woman translates a song's lyrics, forming graceful shapes of sadness with her hands. During the solos, she sways a little bit, waiting for the singer to start in again. She overly mouths the words of the song, but the words are so big anyway. Cry, love, gun, night, whiskey, guilty, baby, why? She's only really doing them justice. Our applause is a thunderous rustle of leaves. Then a young man stands in her place, his hands together, almost prayerful, ready to carve the next vengeful hem into the air. A little shift of form for a couple of poems. One section of my book is entitled Peep Shows, and they're short pieces written in prose. And since they're very narrative, I actually tend to think of them more as what I guess is being called instant fiction than prose poems. This last group of poems and or very short fiction sort of close on the sort of dual theme of relationships, which gets played out at different points in my book. And it was interesting putting this collection together and more recent poems. A lot of energy in American writing, is rightfully so, is taking place in communities of people of color, people who are exploring different lifestyles, people who are away from what would be called sort of the traditional center of culture, and that's where often the energy is. So, you know, What's a rural white guy going to write about in America, somebody who is a part of the sort of privileged class? One of the things that seems to me that's a real theme for anybody, any male writing, is exactly that. What's the status of being a male in the United States when that's a role that has really changed, I think, greatly in the last 40 or 50 years? So with that long introduction, I'm going to read two of these little kind of instant fictions. The first one I want to read is, this one I wanted to read because the impetus for it was a visit to the Kredzegi Art Museum here. There's a wonderful bit of sculpture there by Rodin. It's a bronze. It was part of his, as I mentioned in the piece, his ambitious and unfinished work called The Gates of Hell. I knew immediately I wanted to write something about that because this figure, there's even a little sign at the museum that this was a piece that was physically cut from the rest of the sculpture. And there's a little sign that said, notice the hacksaw scars on the figure's back. It was a wonderful image of being torn away from something. Rodin on loneliness. The University Art Museum is quiet. A few students drift in and then back out again. But only one young man smelling of marijuana studies anything with more than passing interest, except for the woman. She is sitting on a low marble bench staring at a figure by Rodin. At her side is a shiny black vinyl purse she should have checked at the desk, but the undergraduate working there let the motherly-looking woman walk right past. The bronze figure is lying on its side with one partial arm outstretched, which makes it appear that it might be trying to swim or fly. A small sign informs the woman that this was a rejected part of Rodin's ambitious and unfinished Gates of Hell. Notice the hacksaw scars on the figure's back, the sign says. The gallery's single guard wonders what she's doing here. They don't draw in many non-students. She could have wandered in from viewing a body at the funeral home just off campus. The help here has seen it before. But she isn't teary-eyed or distraught. She seems content to try to imagine the sculpture in its original setting among smooth-finished sinners. She hits the sidewalk. She seems content to try to imagine the sculpture in its original setting among smooth-finished sinners. She hits the sidewalk just as students are pouring out of the classrooms. They surge and eddy around her, sometimes arm in arm, or else stop to kiss before rushing on. I'm going to read a pair of poems. The first one is entitled, it's another one of these kind of instant fictions, entitled First Marriage. This really very much was a fictional piece, which again makes me want to call these things instant fictions and prose rather than kind of prose poems. This was another poem I wanted to read this evening because in my imagination and putting the piece together, I very much saw the little scene in here where the people are playing tennis is where the old courts used to be here by the big tower, with the big MAC tower, before they moved them somewhere where I could never find them after they moved them. I don't think there's anything else to mention in here. First marriage. They found their rings in a velvet-lined box of costume jewelry in a head shop just off campus. Their wedding photos show the two of them wearing the telltale goofy grins of very good Colombian. Within days, the rings turned the skin on their fingers in unhealthy-looking gray, so they embarked upon what they called their ringless marriage. There was a huge futon covered with an Indian print cloth and an American flag tacked to the ceiling to shade a bare bulb. There was smoke from joints, from burned curry, from a hibachi on a rickety, rain-worn table on the tiny patio of their third-floor efficiency. A pungent haze which made them feel their Midwest college town might almost be Calcutta or Tangier. They went to a free summer screening of Casablanca and left in the middle to make love. In cutoffs and sunglasses, they played inelegant tennis. on the deserted courts behind the stadium until other students began returning for the fall term. They told themselves that it didn't matter, that nothing really had changed, not even when one or the other would come home late. They decided upon at the library as an acceptable lie. By mid-semester, the leaves were off the trees and morning frost outlined them on the campus sidewalks. He was learning how Shakespeare's mood, how Shakespeare's weather established mood, how an October sky became a blue you couldn't avoid. I'm going to finish with two more poems. After first marriage, there is often second marriage, which is the title of the next poem. I was thinking about sort of the impetus for this poem is I had come across some family photos which I hadn't seen in a while and was looking at photos of my brother's second wedding. And it suddenly occurred to me that at least in my part of the country that first marriages take place in churches and second marriages take place in living rooms. And that says something, I think, about the different expectations that get entered into. I don't think there's anything else to gloss in this poem. This is another one of those poems that for those, again, who are interested in such things, are sort of written in a kind of loose blank verse. Second marriage. They wake up in the room above the chapel, which this time around, I'm sorry, let me start that entirely over. Second marriage. They wake up in the room above the chapel, which this time around is their living room. The flower girl and ring bearer still asleep in their adjoining pastel sanctums, dreaming of their various parents. Somewhere the best man is dressed in red, crouched beneath a stark maple this first day of deer season, gray morning of low clouds. At home, the maid of honor pads cold linoleum and laces coffee with scotch. Last night, the bride wandered into sleep over whether to wear her first wedding gown or the blue of her best friend's betrothal. The groom knows that by the time the honeymoon has waned, the Catholics will already have resurrected their chipped nativity, which makes him think back to the claws he removed from his neighbor's old bathtub to halo the Madonna she planted in her backyard. They know now there are partings before death. They suspect that winning tickets and health would be better than for poorer and croup. Still, they have new rings and a babysitter so they can spend a weekend in Pentwater. They have fifths of whiskey, liters of soda, and a refrigerator which is lit from within by huge bowls of coleslaw. They will have the instant memory of photographs that develop by themselves and cake layered with icing and topped by plastic bells. The minister will ask if anyone objects and tell the groom that he needn't slip him that 50. But they couldn't get a plumber for that much. And besides, the groom knows how to fix almost anything he can work a wrench around. And what he doesn't know, he is determined this time to figure out or live with broke. Again, thanks to the MSU Library and Peter Berg for inviting me this evening. I want to finish with again, a somewhat newer poem. For many years, I resisted the urge to write love poems, which was pretty easy urge to resist when you're not in love for several years. Once that situation remedied itself, I got over the feeling that I had as a younger man that love poems were somehow cliche and had been overdone in the history of English literature. So this is a poem that I tried to get by the sentimentality by starting out with a few lines of suitable bitterness before I get down into the celebratory part of it. And this is a poem for Sue, who is here this evening. This is entitled The Every Day From Now On. Sometimes, half hidden behind snow fences, along potholed county roads, past ancient baseball diamonds, whose facets are now all weed-choked and the players grown roomy, or else distant with senility, you'll see the salvage yards of old Fords and Chevys, a few of whose parts might really have been of use about a marriage and the half of the owner's life ago, or half a liver, two bookkeepers, three bitter kids, however you want to measure. Which is only to say that's how I long felt, built for speed, loosed upon the world with hoopla, and then no longer even in the breakdown lane. I could feel something gnawing and making a nest in the coils beneath the blue vinyl of my life. That was the year I quit singing, when words seemed like sad things constructed from a California box, which before the digital age they used to keep little bits of type in. Sad things constructed from a California box, which consisted entirely of consonants. The world was thick and guttural, viscous as oil. Those lovely patterns hidden secretly within chaos lost their shimmering ability to become suddenly visible like northern lights or neon flickering inexplicably on. Life imitated art, but only the worst sort, assemblages of the least interesting things, losing lottery tickets, discarded ballpoint pens, a page from a paperback romance novel. But then, out of all of that, you take my hand, and we admire, without irony, the classic cars lining Main Street on the 4th of July, desire catching us unaware in front of a turquoise Thunderbird that not even God could have restored with more love, tolerance, or attention to detail. The world becomes suddenly all vowel, a moan deep in the back of the throat, all short A or else long O, and art imitates life's most remarkable parts, numbers chosen solely on the basis of hope, ink curly-cued out into notes reminding us to buy bread and wine, this exact grain and year, this beginning, this end, this long, luscious middle. Thank you. If you do have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them, or would be happy to hang around more informally, or both. Yes?
In your essay, it's kind of crazy about the
We were just talking before the reading a little bit, and being from Michigan, if you're a writer, a young writer in Michigan, I think you're extraordinarily lucky because of the place Michigan has in literary history. I think one of the great poets of the 20th century is Theodore Rethke. Rethke was an influence on me fairly early on. When I look back at the people I was influenced by, early on, I was drawn to those writers who were the most extreme. I read a lot of the French and Surrealist poets in translation. Unfortunately, my French and Spanish were never good enough to read or anything in the original. But poets like André Breton, later on César Vallejo from the Spanish. From there, I got interested in poets who used surrealism but other elements in their writing, like perhaps the greatest poet of the 20th century, Pablo Neruda. Later on, became interested in poets closer to being, who were contemporary while I was in college. I think one of the remarkable post-war poets is the Minnesota poet James Wright. So those were some of the people early on. I think very much that Robert Danos, the French poet, André Breton, Vallejo, those were the people. Somehow I know that as a young reader, I wasn't getting the entire poem. I was kind of getting just the surface, but the surface was enough for me back then because the surface was so cool. So does that answer your question? Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, I want to, which I have not done, it was negligence on my part. If you haven't picked up a copy or subscribed to Fourth Genre, you should do so, which is a journal published by the Michigan State University Press. I'm one of the associate editors. Its full title is Fourth Genre, Explorations in Nonfiction. So it's a journal that publishes strictly nonfiction, although a wide range of nonfiction. We're interested in some nonfiction that's really quite experimental. And it's going very well. We were recently cited by the Utney Reader as one of the about a dozen journals that they cited for general excellence in writing. So we are very pleased by that. The Utney Reader has also reprinted at least one of the essays that we published by Brett Lott, who was an Oprah writer. His essay is also being reprinted in the Pushcart Prize anthology. And it's my understanding that that's going to be the lead piece in the anthology, but I haven't seen that yet. So yeah, we're real pleased with the way it's going. And tell your friends and neighbors that it makes a great Christmas gift. What? Oh, yeah, and if you are a writer or know people who are writers, yeah, we are at the beginning of a submission period, too. So we are actively reading essays for consideration for the journal. And we're real open to young writers. I think the only thing that may have surprised me about the Utney Reader choosing Fourth Genre was that it's a new journal. We're only in our second year. And also, we do publish, Sue Silverman, who is also one of the associate editors, we publish a lot of young writers. And I guess that was the only surprise for Utney Reader choosing is that we haven't published a lot of big names, but we've published some terrific work, and I think that that's what they recognized. In fact, the issue that is going to be out very soon, December, I think is going to be our best to date. It's a very, very fine issue. So, and it's also the MSU Press does a really, really dynamite job in the design of the journal. So check it out. Any other questions? Yes.
I've always admired your title, Fourth Greatest Gifts. And I find that my idea is about the title shift from music to baseball to boxing. Do you have any particular idea? Kind of deconstruct.
Two things. One, which I don't think a general reader would probably get. For me, it was kind of an in-joke. It was a poem. It was a book I'd worked on for years, literally years, before it was published. So I thought entitling your first book Greatest Hits was sort of like, you may never get another shot, so why not have a Greatest Hits the first time out of the shoot? The other thing is, I had played around with different organizations of the poems, and then finally hit on sort of putting in these different thematic categories. And I really did at some point I really did think of the book kind of as almost kind of like as a Sgt. Pepper's album. You know, it was kind of like a concept album. It's a book that kind of poses as a selected poems, but it's a new book. So that my idea was kind of like, well, I'm gonna put the book together almost as though I were pulling the books from these other disparate kinds of books, kind of as a selected poems, but it's a first book. So that was my idea behind it. And Greatest Hits was the best of a series of really awful titles I had too. So it was the best I could do when it finally got down to the crunch time for it. Yeah. I thought my next book I'll entitle Even Greater Hits. are like the all-time most wonderful poems. I don't know, but my working title for my next book is entitled Hieroglyphics in Crayon. Yes or no? Okay. All right. I'll take that as a general affirmation. Anything else? No, what was your... Did I not answer your question? Okay, so what was it?
Would you do an encore, give the title?
Oh. Oh, okay. Then that will be the official end. Let me read one more quick poem then. And then I'll be around. I'll be happy to talk informally. So this is sort of the idea that this was somehow based on almost like being a concept album. The first section is a group of poems based on a fictional musician called Father John McCrae. So this is I included one poem, which was the lyrics to a fictional song by a fictional singer-songwriter. This is the poem entitled Lyrics to Separation. Divorce the body from the mind, leave the thinking part behind. Oh, baby, baby, yes, it's true. This is what I'm trying to do. Here's the body, there's the soul. Here's the thread and there's the hole. Here's the sleeve and there's the arm. Here's the cold and there's the warm. Here's the wheat, there's the chaff. Here's the mouth, there's the laugh. Here's the word, there's the deed. Here's the vein, there's the bleed. Here's the tree, there's the leaves. Here's the warp, there's the weave. Here's the salesman, there's the wheedle. Here's the spoon, and here's the needle. You're the headline, all the news. I'm the back page, obit blues. You're the princess, I'm the toad. You're the river, and I'm the road. Take the lock and take the key. Take the salt and take the sea. Leave the question, leave the rust. Leave the Bible and leave the dust. Divorce the body from the mind. Leave the thinking part behind. Oh, baby, baby, yes, it's true. This is what I'm trying to do. Thank you all again.